Good morning and welcome to this Wednesday morning edition of the Gareth Cliff Show on The Real Network. I'm here with Jack Motlanthe, and hopefully your day is off to an awesome start.
Yes, sir. If you're listening or watching, then your day just started off the perfect way.
Well, we hope so. If we're not doing it right, you can tell us, especially if you are a subscriber.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't charge, but you can go on there and subscribe. 50,000 Rand up for grabs today at some point, because we're almost there, 49,900 and something. So it could be you, who knows? And we're not going for that 50,000th one. There are a lot of factors that come into it. You'll see all the terms and conditions, but we've got some money to give away, which is always nice.
Yep.
And who doesn't want free money at this stage and in this economy, right? We're 60 subscribers away. Very nice, James. Thank you for checking that for us. 60,000 people. 60 people.
60,
and then we'll be at 50,000. Okay, very good. So apparently a new law was signed just the other day by the president that will affect e-hailing services like Bolt and Uber.
Okay.
Apparently the National Land Transportation Amendment Act clarifies how e-hailing businesses operate and brings them under national regulation. Apparently, the industry has been waiting for details on how the new regulations will impact pricing and drivers' earnings. They're seen as a big win for e-hailing companies in South Africa. Apparently, it's given them a lot of clarity on how these businesses can operate legally. Until now, there has been some uncertainty. The new law will help to legitimize the industry and give companies the confidence to invest in South Africa. The Economic Regulation of Transport Bill is another positive development, blah, 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 blah. But it sounds like good news all around. Give people options, right?
Yeah.
Just give people options. It is disgusting that in this country, so many people who have jobs where they just have enough money. They just have enough money to pay the transport to get to and from work.
Yeah.
That is just so unsustainable. And it's because the state insists on this huge levy on the fuel.
Mm-hmm.
It's because they use that fuel levy to pay for building of roads and everything else, because clearly they're squandering so much of our other tax. But people pay a fortune to get to and fro. If you just ask somebody at work today how many taxis they have to catch from A to B, maybe also a train. Some people, it's a train, two taxis, then they have to walk a distance as well. It just ends up being an outrageous cost for people. So give people options.
Yep.
Of course, it's only very, very wealthy people who'll be able to choose all of the options, but at least for everybody, there are choices then.
And that's more important to me than stupid things like social grants and all of this stuff.
Well,
how about you help people get to a point where they can genuinely help themselves? And doing these kind of things just helps. And it's a blanket help, like for everybody. We're so quick to put ourselves in these little pockets and whatnot and call each group or community special for whatever stupid reason. But like, the truth of the matter is that when you help people get on the same level, it's up to them whether they use the initiative to get what they need to or not.
The irony is, I just think about how many Uber drivers I've spoken to who didn't have a job until they could drive a car for Uber. And obviously, they're not making huge money. No one is. The margins are very slim, and Uber takes a big slice of that pie. But I bet Uber's given more people employment than government.
I think so, too.
Because government can't make jobs, right? They can only create more of a tax burden.
Mm-hmm.
So if you create a government job, what you're doing is you're costing the taxpayer more money.
The guy who drove me here this morning, so he got into e-hailing using someone else's car.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have to pay that guy 2,000 Rand every week. And he did so for 5 years to the point whereby he bought his car. In fact, the car he drove me here in, he got 2 weeks ago.
Amazing.
Right?
Isn't that a good story?
That is an amazing story.
If you don't find that empowering, if you don't think that's a good story, you don't know what a good story is.
You really don't. Because, I mean, here's a person who made a decision to put in the work. They weren't handed anything. And he decided to put all of this stuff together. And now he's got a car. And he was telling me about his plans about getting a second car. So the car dealership that he got his car from, they told him if he doesn't skip any payments for 6 months, he can get a second vehicle. Now he's going to have an employee as well. Can you imagine?
That's great. Yeah, I met a woman last year who was driving an Uber. And I thought, this is amazing, first of all, because she was driving around late at night on her own, and you never know what kind of people you're going to get asking for a lift. But she told me she's been doing this for 6 or 7 years, and she now owns 2 cars.
Mm-hmm.
And her son drives the one because he couldn't get a job. She drives the other one. They own the cars. They've paid them off.
Mm-hmm.
And she's making a tidy profit. She wants to get to 3 or 4 cars, and then she's like a kingpin, like a taxi boss.
There you go.
Which is fantastic. Now, again, I wonder if you calculated all the jobs that have come about as a result of government or government policy, of which there are bitter few and way too many policies, and you compared that to how many jobs Uber's created, I think Uber would win.
Mm.
In other words, Uber's better running the economy than government. We're back to Javier Milei all of a sudden. So, all right, we can talk about cars. Maybe it's better to save those things for when George Meany's in, because he's got so much to talk about. But you had, I don't know the story at all. There's a story about 6 schizophrenic brothers.
You, Gareth.
And what, this is a documentary or something?
It's a documentary. Let me start off by saying, I thought my family had just enough problems and just enough happiness for us to be a healthy bunch. Okay. And then I came across this documentary. So,
oh my God.
This family, they're in Colorado. Of course, it happened in the States, but the parents got married in 1940, and they started having kids in 1945 all the way up until 1965. They had 12 kids, Gareth, in total. Sure. Same man, same woman. God bless that woman. Like, it's like madness.
You got to have some serious respect for a mom who's given birth to anything more than 3 kids.
Right? I
mean, even a mom who's given birth to 1 deserves a lot of respect. But imagine 12.
So, from 1945 until 1965, she had Donald, Jim, John, Brian, Michael, Richard, Joseph, Mark, Matthew, Peter, Margaret, and Mary. 10 boys, 2 girls.
Sure.
Now, of the 12 kids, 6 of them ended up with schizophrenia. Were diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Sure. Okay. Schizophrenia is a very serious mental health condition.
It is
about, you know, we're not talking about someone who has too many distractions. I've got ADHD. I'm not able to concentrate. We're not talking about somebody who's anxious.
No.
These are serious, serious conditions.
These are people who were diagnosed with this mental illness. 6 out of the 12. That's literally half of the family. Now, naturally, because of their mental illness, they all kind of scattered into different directions. But the mom, interestingly enough, tried to keep them in the house as long as possible. So the firstborn son started showing symptoms really, really early. So he was like 17, 18 years old when he started showing symptoms. And they got him a bit of treatment. He went to college. By the time he came back, like, all bets were off. At this point in time, whenever he'd get into arguments with his parents, he'd smash all the windows in the house. He'd complain about hearing voices and all of this stuff.
This family needed more drama.
Listen. And it kind of started a ripple effect, because once Don, the firstborn son, Donald, once he started kind of, you know, losing it, as a coping mechanism, they try to help out as much as they could. But a lot more of them started showing symptoms and at random points in time. It's such a devastating story to watch, because right at the end, you find out that of the 12, there's 9 of them who are still alive. The youngest daughter, Mary, is taking care of her mentally ill brothers.
One of them.
No, yeah. Well, not in the same house, but like keeps tabs on them and all of this stuff.
This woman is.
My goodness. And her child, unfortunately. So she's got 2 kids of her own. Son is 22 years old. And he has anxiety and all of this stuff because he found out that 6 of his uncles had schizophrenia.
You see, I think there's such a thing as bad genes. I hate to say it.
Yeah.
But this is not pure nature. I mean, pure nurture. This is nature.
Yep.
I mean, it sounds to me like if 6 people out of 12 have a really serious condition. And now in the next generation, there are signs of that happening again. It's like someone somewhere, nature is trying to just nudge you in a direction of like, yeah, you're not the one to have more kids.
Mm-hmm.
Stop right here. This is a good place to stop. Let the family tree just end the branch right there.
Can you, like Mary's son. So Mary is the youngest of the 12 siblings. And her son was kind of like, the mom kind of wants to normalize mental illness, well, at least the conversation around it. So she exposed her kids to her brothers. And when they saw just how unhinged some of them could be in their manic moments,
mm-hmm.
the kids have been freaking out ever since. Like, I hope that is not my reality. The son is just waiting to turn 26 because apparently that's the cutoff for when, you know, schizophrenia can actually take over your life, essentially.
I wouldn't know what to do in that situation.
I wouldn't know either.
I feel very sorry for them, but at the same time, I don't know why they make documentaries about people like this, because they're trying to, I suppose, normalize stuff, but it's not normal.
It's
this is very bad.
It is absolutely horrible.
I don't
horrible.
See a happy story coming from this.
No, not at all. I mean, right at the end of the, so it's a 4-part documentary. Right at the end of it, they point out that this family was the perfect test subjects in order to identify the gene, you know, to figure out whether or not schizophrenia could be a part of your future or not. But I mean, having to deal with all of that stuff, the father at some point had a stroke.
Oh my God.
So this woman
had to get any better.
It is hectic.
All right. So
hectic.
Another thing. It's like, just be grateful for you and your problems. Like you were saying at the very beginning of this, you're like, you look at your family and you go, oh, we've got just the right amount of trouble and the right amount of happiness.
Oh,
there's so much that could go wrong. There's so much bad shit out there. Just like, count your blessings and count your problems and be grateful for them.
Listen,
you wouldn't want other people's problems.
Like, it's the name of the documentary, by the way, is Six Schizophrenic Brothers.
Mm.
And it's on Amazon
Kinda
Prime.
Kind of tells you on the box what it's all about.
Hey? Yeah. And when I saw the title, I thought, okay, this might be interesting. But my word, it is insane. And I don't use that word lightly. It is crazy.
I wouldn't watch this. I thank you for telling me about it, because otherwise I'd never have known. But I wouldn't watch this. I said it the other day, and I really mean this. Like, I'm not taking in stuff that's going to make me feel bad. I don't even have emotional capacity for the people I do care about in my life.
Mm.
I struggle to be in the feelings the whole time, right?
Yeah.
And that's what most people are most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not expected to also have feelings, or I'm made to care by a documentary, which is clearly very emotive, I'm made to care about some family I'll never meet with all of their problems. I don't know why people do this to themselves. I'm glad you watched it, so you warned me against watching it, but I would not be, you could not, wild horses could not drag me to watch this documentary. I hate it. It's like watching those crime and investigation things, serial killer stuff. I don't want to know. It's not in my life, and I don't want to know. I don't need it. Thank you. I'm happy to watch dumb stuff.
Yeah.
I will watch people doing dumb shit on TikTok or on Instagram or wherever. I don't have TikTok, Instagram, but wherever else. And then that'll fill my quotient for entertainment. You are very brave, and many people who watch these things are brave enough to watch them. I'm not interested.
You know,
sorry.
What? For whatever reason, I've learned how to separate what I'm watching and my emotions. So like, if it pops up on the screen to me, it's no different to cartoons. Like, it'd be like, okay, I feel something, but like, it doesn't sit with me. I just keep it moving. And some of these stories are really enlightening, man. Like, you actually realize that human beings are a lot more resilient than we give ourselves credit for. More often than not, you don't know what you'd be willing to live with up until you don't have a choice. And, you know, some of these stories shed light on just how many silver linings there are.
Really, Richard says, I guess that phrase first child is like pancakes. You throw it away when you when you decide I'm no good at making pancakes. After 6, 12? Yeah. I always wonder, because it seems to me like, you know, there's this another documentary that I remember from ages ago that I found. It was like dark humor more than it was something I needed to feel sorry for. It's this really inbred family in I think they're in Appalachia in America. It's this they're called the I can't remember their surname now.
Is this the family with the one kid that barks instead of
they
talking?
They bark and they they're really really inbred. And I remember watching this thing and the guy goes. The whole time. And it was like, you know, for if you just want to laugh and you don't have to get involved, like you said, you can separate the feelings.
Yeah.
Then it's quite interesting to watch. But at the same time, I look at this stuff and I just think we what happened to entertainment? Like we have good stories, you know? There are the classics. And somebody said, I loved it the other day. Someone told me that they watched, I think it was Sense and Sensibility or Little Women or one of those 18th century women's authors, Jane Eyre or one of the Brontes. There were so many of them, three of them. And I thought those are great stories. But if you go back even further, there are the classics. Like, you know, you've got the amazing stories that were written in the Iliad by Homer, the Odyssey. The stories from ancient Greece and Rome that are just magnificent. And people have their own stories. Now they're creating stories.
Mm-hmm.
Stories from our own backyards, which are not all about these really dark parts of humanity. I think we can do better than this. Like, what about heroes? What about people who've done incredible and brave things?
I think
there are lots of good stories. We don't have to go and find inbred families and six schizophrenic fucking brothers.
Do you know, I think it's
enough.
It's an information overload. With all the movies that have been produced, all of the series and all of this stuff, we've seen heroes a bit too much, I think. So the more broken people are, people gravitate
right.
towards that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you may be. And it makes people feel better.
Yeah.
They watch that stuff and they go, oh, I may be bad, but I'm not that bad.
Yeah.
So it makes them feel a bit better about themselves. You are probably on the money here.
Mm-hmm.
Bitcoin Butt says, back in the day, we'd go to the circus to see a child bark. Puppy boy. Now it's common.
Yeah.
Gays even like them. Well, that's the furries. That's a whole other thing.
That's a whole
the Whitakers.
Other...
That's their surname. Quite right. Thank you, Raven. The Whitakers. That's the surname of the family in Appalachia who have these. I mean, it's bad. So what happened was two brothers, their children got married. And then from there on, they just kept it in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And they live, I mean, just the conditions these people live in, it's just disgusting. They're all wearing dirty clothes. And they're like, you know, it's very, very depressing, even if it's funny in the beginning, because you watch it and you can't believe what you're watching.
Right.
It's like, it's a freak show. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, going back to that woman with the tattoos all over her face earlier, because that other lady said, keep it in the circus. But I think we've taken the freak shows and we've just put them, center stage. So now the freak shows, which used to be on the fringes, are now getting the spotlight. And I'm not so sure that we want to see that in living, vivid color.
It's a
bit terrifying, actually. What do you think about Queen Elizabeth and Philip being first and second? They weren't first, they were second cousins, but it's still close. And
it is.
That's why Charles's eyes are close. Shame. Poor old Charles. I saw he's busy entertaining the Japanese emperor and empress at the moment. There was a big dinner at Buckingham Palace last night for the king and the queen and the emperor and the empress.
You know, some people just have all the luck, man.
In 2024, there are still kings and emperors dying with each other with gold cutlery and, you know.
Yeah, forget the fact that for hundreds of years, there were revolutions trying to get rid of all of those emperors and queens and queens and shit. It's crazy.
So you got the Whitakers, and the Windsors. Take your pick.
Yep.
All right. So there's a couple of interesting stories going on. There's a couple of comments here that we must refer to. So I basically decided to save some people some time. You know, in the interest of saving time, I'm always about efficiency. I was like, here are a couple of things that if you are a friend of mine on social media, or if you follow me on social media, this will help you to determine whether that's still a worthwhile endeavor for you and for me, possibly.
Right.
So I got a list, okay? So a quick guide to unfriending me. First of all, if you post pro-Hamas lies and propaganda, I'll be disappointed, but life is too short to argue with terrorists, so maybe you should just leave so that I don't have to cancel you. If you tell me that you were pro-lockdown and pro-vax back in 2020, but that you still maintain those positions now, despite even the drug companies admitting that their vaccines might have been very dangerous, but certainly didn't stop transmission or any of the other effects that they promised, then you're very stupid and I can't be friends with you anymore.
Yeah, I think I'm going to take that one as well.
Number three, if you post pictures or videos of animal abuse, even if you're trying to help, I don't want to see that stuff. It's like the crime and investigation shit. There's enough going on in the world. I don't need to be upset by this. I know that there are shitty people doing horrible things to people and animals, but I don't want to see it. There used to be this general idea that, you know, snuff films where people kill people shouldn't be seen. Now, you could go onto your feed on something as urbane as Instagram, and you will see people being hit by cars.
Yep.
I don't want to see that stuff. And I certainly don't want to see animals being abused. So I'm out if that's what you're into. Number four, ask for money. If you ask for money, I don't want to hear from you. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, these are not for panhandling. Stop asking people you don't know for money. It's embarrassing.
Yeah, it is, really. Actually.
Number five, if you tell me that you think Joe Biden is perfectly capable of running the U.S. for another 4 years, you and he need to be put in a nursing home.
Like with immediate effect, like immediately. Yesterday, immediately.
There was a new video that came out yesterday, and I know that, you know, the White House press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, is trying to tell people that there's this thing called, what does she call it? Cheap fakes. So it's not deep fakes. It's not actually fake footage. But she's like, oh, it's out of context, and you're cutting clips that make the president look bad. They showed a video yesterday of Joe Biden. Again, I can't help it. This stuff is coming up on my feed. And I've tried to eliminate the bullshit, but it's very hard.
Yeah.
There's a video of him getting into a car, just getting into a car, right? It takes him 2 minutes to get into the car.
That's
very bad. And okay, so that's another one that instantly is like, also, please, number six, can we stop comparing everyone to Hitler? Like, Hitler was really bad and probably way worse than anyone that you're comparing him with. Just because you don't have any other historical reference points, because you only know Hitler, let's stop watering that down. I mean, Hitler was pretty goddamned awful.
Yep.
And if you think that your school guidance counselor was mean to you once, so they're just like Hitler, I can't take you seriously. You need to be taken off my feed.
No, it's the over exaggeration, the hyperbole, and what ultimately happens is that those kind of terms get watered down to the point whereby it becomes fodder and no one gives it its right due.
Yeah.
Like, just, that guy was an absolute monster.
Yeah.
Let's stop comparing him to.
Please, like, don't, everything, like, don't compare anyone. Just try not to compare anyone to Hitler. It's a very bad idea. You're going to come up looking stupid yourself.
There's tons of bad people. Pick one.
Please don't have green or blue or purple hair. I can't be friends with you if you do, because that's the sign almost all the time. I've met maybe a couple of people who break the rule, but almost all of them severe mental illness. You need a psychiatrist, not a Facebook friend. Number eight, and this is a big one. It might not seem serious, but it is. If you use your wedding picture as a profile picture, but you got married more than 6 months ago. What you're really admitting is that that was the best that you've ever looked and that you've been downhill since then. And if you've been downhill for like 8 years and you still got your wedding pic from 8 years ago, it's embarrassing.
But Gareth, it was the happiest day of my life.
I know, but you can still have it in your album. But to have it as your profile picture, especially on things like LinkedIn, okay? Like a lot of these are social media apps. So I'll forgive you a little bit more. But if you're posting any of this stuff on LinkedIn, that's embarrassing beyond belief because now you're humiliating yourself in the business world as well.
Yep.
Right? Also, number nine, this might seem unkind, but don't be sad because nobody cares. And this is not the place to look for therapy or for support.
Yeah.
Okay. So don't be sad if you want to have friends like Jack and I.
Mm-hmm.
On social media. And just don't be sad.
Like,
stop.
Just so you know, you're not being clever either. Like, you know how some girls break up with someone and they want to let the whole world know that they are doing just fine. But in the meantime, we can see the 15 posts in 1 hour proving that you're not fine.
No, you're not. Exactly.
I'm going into my soft girl era. No, you're going into your lonely, sad girl era. That's what's going on. And you just don't want to admit it. Okay?
Oh, boy. All right. So I kept it to around 10.
Yeah.
The last one is, you don't have to explain that you are white or black or lesbian or disabled or anything that we can see from the picture.
Yeah.
Because we believe it or not, we can tell from the picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like, I'm a black lesbian. Well, I can see that.
Pick it up.
I can see that from your picture and the hardware shoes that you're wearing in the picture. So we can all tell that. And if you think that your race or your sexuality or your opinion on something is the most interesting thing about you, there's probably not that much interesting stuff about you.
Mm.
So let's just save each other a lot of time and not be friends.
I think, you know, that's why people treat social media as an actual place because their actual lives are rather dull.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've heard people say things like, yo, the internet is such a mean place.
No.
Like, no.
It's not.
It's not. No, it's not. Like, you can't feed the internet bullshit and then expect no bullshit to come in your direction. Like, what are we doing?
Like anything, it's what you make it.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're just looking for the wrong thing in the wrong place.
Yeah.
You know, let's just be sensible about this. So if any of that made you very unhappy, I'm terribly sorry. But what can I say? Again, efficiency is king.
Yes.
All right. Yes. So let's turn our attention now to something else, which I think will help us get our efficiency right. We try to bring interesting people into the studio. Today is no different to all the other days where we bring interesting people in. And this guy especially is going to help us to figure out how the unhealthy habits of leaders contribute to their poor performance. And we're going to have an exploration with him of the neuroscience of leadership, as well as how politicians in particular reduce their capacity to lead with destructive personal cultures. And maybe this will ring a bell or two for those of us who are feeling maybe we could do better as well. His name is Velin Daba. He was born in Soweto, in Mdeni, to be specific. He's got a Bachelor of Science degree in Management Science. He's got a National Diploma in Mechanical Engineering and a Diploma in Project Management. He does life coaching, neuro-linguistic programming, and he's a thought leader and pioneer of a leadership high-performance tool called the Veli Ndaba Neuroengineering Leadership Effect. Now, if that doesn't interest you, then I don't know what will. Because that sounds pretty fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. Veli, it's nice to have you here.
Hey, great. It's nice to be here, Gareth. Thank you so much.
To see you. This is a fascinating overlap of two areas most people would not associate with each other.
Yeah.
Like the idea of mechanical engineering at one point, and then like social and psychological stuff on the other, neuro-linguistic programming, which I think everybody accepts now as a pretty tried and tested way of changing bad behavior.
Absolutely. I think what we tend to do is that we create binary conditions in life. It's either this or that.
Yeah.
So we've got to find a way in terms of how we can bridge these things together, because it doesn't always work like that. If you either have this or that, so why can't you have both? So for me, I think it's about that, because you always ask this question. You're an engineer, but how did you get into this? And I think it's about the fascination. you know, that I have.
So let's just start off with neuro-linguistic programming and this idea that you've got this neuroengineering leadership effect. Yes. So what is NLP for people who don't know?
NLP means neuro-linguistic programming. It's basically, it's all about understanding how the brain works and in terms of the programs that we get to be, you know, adapted to. Because, I mean, like, as you live, you get to learn different things, I mean, like, through other people. Mm-hmm. And they become a way of life for you. So that's something. For an example, if you end up being scared of snakes, you know, no one was just born scared. Yeah. But it's something that you learned, you know, as you grew up, you know, based on what you experienced and what you saw.
Right.
Like I'll normally ask people, especially when I deal with leaders, to say, how do you eat an apple? I mean, people say, no, I take it out and I clean it and I cut it, or others I bite it. And I say, but is there any curriculum that where that stuff was covered? How did you learn that? You know, someone said, no, and because people will give you different things. You know, this is how I eat it. And I said, but what got you to eat an apple like that? And people say, no. But in retrospect, they realize that, you know, that's how they watch others eating it.
And by I say, observation.
So that's what we call monkey see, monkey do. So there are many things in our brains. I mean, we've got something called mirror neurons. I mean, things that we learn better by observing people.
Right.
You know, do things. And then we end up...
Especially when you're a kid, your parents, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That's the first place. I mean, I was monkey see, monkey do with my parents for... probably up to at least age 4 or 5 before I started having any other inputs.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly happened. It helps you to adapt, and it helps you to, you know, to understand how life, you know, happens around you, so that you can be able to live with other people. So it unfortunately, you know, what tends to happen is that we grow up with that attitude or with that mentality that mm-hmm. it's about monkey see, monkey do. We never question these beliefs. And like that one of an apple, and I say, but what if maybe they say, do you eat the core and the seeds? And they say, no, I don't eat that. I say, why not? Mm. No, this is not the right thing to do. You know, it's very, you know, it's not a good thing to do. And mm-hmm. I say, why not? I said, what if the core of an apple and the seeds are the most interesting part and nutritional part of the apple? They look at me and I say, so we never question things. And because if I had this, you know, like empirical evidence that proves that, you wouldn't say to me, no, I'm wrong. So because you never challenge that, you never question that. So that's trying to say to people, let's try to wake up. Let's try to question things. So with neuroscience and NLP, for an example, is trying to demystify some myths that we all have and that we grew up hearing. For an example, that you can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Mm.
And that as human beings, we only use about 10% of our brain capacity, which is just false.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
People say that and it's a trope. Like that just gets repeated often enough and everybody starts believing it, right?
And to say that, I mean, like one of my quotes, I mean, like Gareth as well, I say, in the absence of evidence, everything becomes a truth.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes back to that. In the absence of evidence, you know, everything becomes a truth.
So it seems to me that there are so many people who are just operating on that programming that was put into them when they were a kid. They don't ever deviate from it, so they don't improve necessarily. New evidence comes up, new information. They don't go with it and change their programming for the better.
Yeah.
And they're almost just existing. They repeat the same patterns. They do the same. And then they complain that their life is horrible.
Yeah.
And that's a problem you can solve.
Yeah.
And NLP is one of the ways of doing that. There are lots of people who believe in other methods. You know, there are tons of things that we've discussed on this show.
Yeah.
That you can do to improve your life. And I suppose it all starts with that, I want to make a change, attitude change, making sure that you do things differently, break old patterns.
Mm-hmm.
But that's easier said than done, right, Vili?
Very true. You know, no two people are exactly the same. And there's a reason why I had to delve into this subject of neuroscience in particular, because neuroscience is just above NLP.
Mm.
Because... coming from an engineering background, I was very fascinated about understanding things from, you know, like from the basics. I mean, like from first principles. I mean, that's something that you get to be taught.
Mm.
Understand things as an engineer. You can't just hope that this thing is going to work.
Yeah.
I mean, there must be some fundamental principles that are informing and that are actually driving this thing to work. You can't just hope for the car to work. I mean, it's based on the principles and it's based on the mechanics, you know, that drives this car to do what it does. So it's the same thing with human beings as well. Unfortunately, but you know, when you look at neuroscience, for an example, it's looking at how the brain works. Neuroscience is a study that looks at the human nervous, the nervous system of human beings, but with the main focus on the brain. So in terms of what makes us do what we do, it brings in the scientific evidence to human behavior. Because many people just say, oh, this is how we do things. But why do we really do that? And we look at things like philosophy and evolution. How did we evolve as a human species from our prehistoric ancestors? Because the brain is all about survival. It's about safety.
Yeah.
It's about energy saving. And it's about thinking. Thinking normally comes at the bottom of this pyramid. Mm. The first thing is survival. So if I don't feel safe, I lose everything. It means I'm not going to focus. If I were to
that's interesting because there are many people, especially in this country, who are struggling to survive.
Yeah.
So if you're in survival mode, the chances are you're not going to be able to think.
You're not.
Even if you want to, and you're a person who believes in the force of will, and you're able to master yourself in whatever way, shape, or form, if you are just in survival mode, you're not going to be thinking, which is why so many people make such terrible mistakes, because they're just trying to survive and they can't switch that part of their brain off, because that's at the center of it, right? That's the primitive, the lizard brain.
Yes.
And that's the part that's keeping them alive.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly that, Gareth, because when you look at the brain normally it's simplified into three parts, or there are three different parts of the brain. Mm. The first one is the thinking brain. The second one is an emotional brain. And then the third one is the survival brain that you referred to as a lizard brain. So that's the one that keeps us, you know, alive. Right now, the heart is beating. You're not consciously controlling it. Mm-hmm. Right now, you're digesting the food. You're not consciously controlling it.
Yeah.
Right now, the heart is, the blood is beautifully regulated, and you're not consciously controlling it. That's the part of the brain that is controlling that. It's the survival brain, and which is the one that started off, at the beginning of time. And then the second one became the emotional brain. That's the one now that ensures that you feel emotions, you experience anger, you experience, things like excitement and happiness. So we all feel, and as mammals, we are the ones that are highly evolved in terms of that brain, because that's why we can take care of our kids until they are 50 or until they are 60. Mm. I know other kids who are still being taken care of at the age of 60.
No, giraffes don't do that.
Yeah, giraffes don't do that. But as humans, we are the ones who are doing that. That tells you how sensitive we are and how close we are in terms of emotions, as human beings. And then the third one is the thinking brain. I'm sure you've heard of this part of the brain that is called the prefrontal cortex. Mm-hmm. That's the one that does the executive functions of the brain. This is the CEO of the brain. That's where you do planning. You do things like strategizing.
But unlike a CEO, it gets overruled by those emotional and lizard brains.
I was coming to that because the thinking brain, when you look, the brain evolved from, back to front.
Yeah.
So it means emotional brain is the big brother. Right. And then the thinking brain is the baby, of the family. So it gets bullied easily, because that's why emotional brain is the one that takes over, because it just says, OK, you're a lighty, you're small. Just take a back seat.
Right.
I'm going to take care of this one. Because why? It's based on survival. Because if our prehistoric ancestors could not survive, we wouldn't be here. So survive. So emotions, therefore, they tend to take over, because they are also, the emotional brain is about 100 times faster than the thinking brain.
Wow.
The thinking brain is such an amazing, part of the brain that does all the, the beautiful things. It thinks about tomorrow, but the emotional brain is in the here and now. Mm. But it's much faster, it's much stronger. It's a bully of the family. So,
which is why half of the time we are rendered speechless, because our prefrontal cortex still needs to develop a little bit more to match up with its older brother.
Yeah, and it will never do that. That's why it is even said that you are only rendered an adult when you're 21. Mm. But it doesn't always work like that. Other people never get to do that, because it doesn't just, mature with age only. It matures based on experiences that you have that you go through.
How do you manage then? Because I'm sure there are loads of people listening and watching now who are thinking, yeah, that's me. Sometimes my emotions get the better of me. Sometimes I'm in survival mode. I can't think. I'm just overwhelmed. It's too much to deal with. How can people gain control? How can they become the CEO then of their own brain and let the thinking brain help them make better decisions, because almost always it does.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in thinking mode and your emotions are regulated and you're not in survival, then you probably will make more sensible, rational, calculated, thoughtful decisions, and you won't be stuck fighting with people or, you know, arguing over a piece of food or something that's completely stupid that all other animals do.
Yeah.
How do we get to that point? Because we're all, there's no one who's mastered this in completion, right?
Absolutely. It's a journey. I mean, that's why I talk a lot about, I mean, when you talk about things like emotional intelligence, that's being emotional in an intelligent way. So it means that what happens between these three brains, for an example, I use this analogy. When you look at the thinking brain, it uses about, I mean, like if you look at in terms of when you look at, I mean, energy, it uses a lot of energy.
Right. Mm.
And then the emotional brain, it uses less energy. Why? Right. Because most of the things that you do are already subconsciously driven. They're already stored in the subconscious mind. I mean, there's part of the brain that we talk about. I mean, it's called basal ganglia. That's the one that drives all the emotions, all the habits. Once you have done something a couple of times, it says, okay, now I've got this thing figured out. Give it to me. Don't think about it anymore. That's when we become we get into autopilot.
Right.
So it means we get into autopilot because the brain says, I only have certain amount of energy. I only have so much, cognitive resources in me. I only have so much glucose. I only have so much oxygen. So I don't have all the time to think, and I cannot. So remember, the second part of the brain is about energy saving.
Right.
So when it saves energy, it makes a box.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why people become lazy, because the brain says, no. Why do it now? Why think about that? That's why you avoid new things. Why? Because they challenge us to think. And thinking is the most difficult thing there is. That's why Henry Ford was saying, thinking is the most difficult thing there is. That's why most people don't think.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have the science to back that one up with. But when you look at it, it's because now science has shown us that the thinking brain is quite costly in terms of energy.
Energy.
So coming back to your question, I think that one, Gareth, to say, how do we train that? It becomes an issue of self-awareness. That's what I teach about. That's what I talk about as well. Because when you understand how the brain works, because people just think that the brain is just one solid thing. It's not. It's got different components. It's got different departments, but they work together seamlessly. But until you understand that they are different, then you'll not be able to control that. So when to control that, to bring in, to make sure that you are not emotionally driven all the time, it's about being able that to understand that the brain evolved to keep us safe. But now the safety that we're talking about, it was physical safety.
Mm.
But now most of the safety we're talking about is not physical. It's emotional and it's social. Mm. So it's not something that's going to kill you.
Yeah,
but the brain has mastered that. So when you take a deep breath, for an example, when someone irritates you, it's not going to kill you. You just take a deep breath. It's about managing your emotions. And so that awareness is something that's important. But when someone upsets you, that animal instinct, you know, comes out and you want to snap off their heads. So self-awareness comes into being then.
So how do you incorporate this into your work? Because I think leadership, we need leaders who are able to master themselves.
Yes.
We need leaders who are self-aware. And I don't see a lot of that. I see a lot of emotion, that middle brain, that second brain, as you call it. I see a lot of survival talk. I see a lot of appealing to other people's emotional brains rather than the sensible stuff. We were talking about this earlier, you know, this president of Argentina who's just shooting the lights out and changing the economy there and making people's lives practically better just by not being stupid. And I said to Jack, well, this just shows you how dumb the other leaders in the world are, because so many of them are caught in that area between the first and second brain, and they're not even getting to the third.
Mm. You know what that, you know, our education system, unfortunately, somehow it seems to be designed in a very bad way, even our society as well. Because when things are made, you know, to be, or when they are constructed in a way that they are not able to take us from this issue of worrying about safety and focus on what matters most, we'll never be able to come out of that. Like another example that I use, I say, if I say in this room here and I say, there's a lot of money here. If you get in here, you can get yourself maybe 5 million, rents. And then you will be so excited. And then the second part, and I said, anyway, there's a trick. And I say, but there's a snake in there as well somewhere. So if you are able to, you know, to go past that snake, then you can have that money. Where is your focus going to be?
Snake.
It's going to be, why? It proves once again that our brain is focusing on survival. It's not, so whatever it is, I mean, if a leader, for example, gets into a room and says, guys, we need to do this. And if you achieve this, I'm going to give you so much money. You're going to get this. And he says, but if it doesn't happen, heads are going to roll. Now, yes. Where is the focus going to be?
Only part people hear is heads are going to roll.
Exactly that. So leaders need to be taught. So that's what I do to teach leaders to understand how human brains work. Because if you understand how the human brain works, how it processes information, because most of us, we have not been taught about that. I mean, even for me, it came out, the last 10 years to get to understand that. So that's the reason why I said, this information is not available. Hence, I started writing a book around that to say, how do you really help leaders? Yes, this is the book here. How do you really help leaders to lead effectively? Because when you talk about this leadership is not just like, because most people are promoted because of their technical skills.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You are a good accountant, you're a good engineer, yeah. Then they promote you.
We see it with people online saying, oh, this one's got a matric, this one's got this degree, that degree. Those things are not the qualifications we need.
Absolutely.
We need people who can think and also who have a moral backbone.
Backbone,
you know?
Yeah.
I just want people who can prove they're skilled in a specific technical respect.
Unfortunately, what happens, Gareth, in terms of that, school has created this entitlement mindset, where we think that because I have a degree, then I'm qualified for that.
Yeah.
And then you get people, I deal with people who've got master's degrees, people who are so highly educated.
Right.
But when you talk with them when it comes to issues of emotions, they are just so cold and they are just not there. And they are not able to engage the thinking brain. Remember right now, we're in this economy that is called, we call it, I mean, like it's knowledge economy. Now, knowledge economy means that we hire people based on their skills and based on their knowledge. But when you're going to bring in someone who is highly educated, someone who can think outside the box, but you hire them to put them inside the box, because that's what happens. We don't give them space. We hire people to come and do beautiful things. But when they get in there, you say, no, I'm the boss here. You know, and someone is highly qualified, he can do something, you know, and bring in new ideas. But you've got leaders who are saying, no, but I'm the boss here. They don't want someone who's going to outshine them. That's where leadership fails, because we bring in people. What's the use of saying, I want someone with a master's degree, and yet you don't give them space to do what they, you know, what they've been taught to do and what they can do? That's why, therefore, you've got people who are, I mean, then politics starts coming in.
Yeah. Well,
and people getting so much stress because you end up not doing what you're supposed to do, but you end up conforming.
That's it. I saw a great clip yesterday. I'm not going to say who it was, because if you mention some people's name in business, then everybody else has the emotional response of, I like them or I don't like them.
Yes.
So everything they say is true and great, or nothing they say is true or useful. So I saw this brilliant clip. The guy says, it is really important that leaders and companies allow people to fail.
Yes.
In other words, to try things, to experiment, to come up with ingenious new ways of doing stuff. And you've got to be prepared to bear the cost of that if you're a leader.
Yeah.
Because if you have the opposite, that you bring people in and then you tell them not to make mistakes, all they're going to do is try to avoid those mistakes. You'll get nothing good out of them.
Yeah.
And I think that there's so much in business in this country that's about people who are terrified to make a mistake, so they rather do nothing.
Absolutely. And that is based on how capitalistic we are. I mean, like as the world. Everyone is focusing on bottom line. It's very unfortunate that we want to do beautiful things, but people don't want to lose money. I mean, it's all about bottom line. We don't care about people. We don't care about the well-being of people.
There has to be some sort of a middle ground.
I mean, to stand up for capitalism for a second, capitalism is also the promise that if you come up with a good idea, you'll make lots of money.
Right.
Yeah.
Nobody's doing this altruistically. No one's standing out there going, well, I want to solve people's problems. They're like, if I manage to solve people's problems, I might make a lot of cash.
There has to be a meeting of the mind somewhere.
Yeah.
And the question is, how confident is the leader? Because it comes back to that. And that's one thing that I talk about. Many things are lost. I mean, they hinge around the confidence level of a leader. If a leader has a low level of confidence, they're not going to give up space because they are focusing about losing their jobs. You're if someone makes a mistake, my head is going to be chopped off. Mm. So it comes back to that. That's the reason why when you look at, when you look at companies, leaders who come in there, everything that they talk about is about profits. But when it comes to people development and looking at the well-being of people, it becomes like the last thing, you know, in the line. They say, even if you talk to people, that's why they are so quick to say, but how much money is this thing going to make us? And when you say, but it's going to develop your people, and in like when you look at it in long term, it's going to have huge spin-offs. And they don't look at that. They want to see the results now and right away.
The thing is, like with life in modern society, it does not incentivize long, hard work. What has become the carrot that is dangled in front of everyone is notoriety and fame, and you don't have to do too much in order for you to get there.
Yeah.
Those kind of things are things that can be unlearned, right? Or is the pressure a bit too much on...
The pressure is there, but those things can be unlearned. Remember, the brain is such an amazing organ. It can learn and it can unlearn things.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the reinforcements the reinforcements that we are seeing. Look at social media. People are just posting all these things. If you just do Forex, you don't have to work hard. Look at me, I'm driving a Lamborghini.
Yeah.
Look at the mansion that I have. And now the young ones don't know better. All they're looking at, these things are being reinforced because they're spending too much time on social media.
Spot
as well.
On.
Mm-hmm. And they're saying, why work hard if I can? No, school is not important. Just go and do this. And they grow up hearing these things.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it's got a very huge impact on how people think and how our youth actually grows up. Even now, even elders, they end up adopting that. They don't want to work hard anymore. They just sit there and expect, more for less or with less.
The incentives have lost. They're gone. There's not enough people that are products of genuine hard work that are championing that understanding at this point in time. Because whether we like it or not, Steve Jobs said it, people don't know what they want until you give it to them, right?
That's true.
Most of the time, what people want and how they get it are very different conversations. Like they know I want a Lamborghini, but how to get there is, as you said, Forex, social media and whatnot, all of these shortcuts.
Yeah. And it's very sad because even now, when I remember, during our days as well, when you qualified and you had to go after varsity days, you go and work in a company, you were exposed. You realize that you knew nothing because you'll be given someone like Garrett said, rightfully, to say you're given someone who has matric. And he will show you that you know nothing. The theory, the degree that you have means nothing. You have to be taught from scratch because you realize that what you were taught, it's basically like devoid of the truth. There's still a lot that you need to learn as a person.
It comes
back to the culture once again.
Yeah.
You know.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I just wanted to find out, is that the survival brain at work? Because that imposter syndrome thing that people have, just like, okay. But is it because we try to protect ourselves from harm? Like, we don't want to be seen as less than?
The issue of not feeling, wanting to feel less than, it's actually part of,
as
human
brain.
Beings. Is that the second
one? The second brain, but as part of human, as human beings, we are very hierarchical in nature. Someone wants to be at the top. No one wants to be at the bottom. That's why even when you look at people on social media, they will even post like, look at my food. Look at what I'm eating. Look at me. Call it the situation right now. When you look at that, it comes back to this issue that no one wants to be known as less than. People want to pitch themselves at the top to say, no. Also, I've got something in me. And that has got an impact as well in how we show up because people want to, to be relevant, even on things that don't really make sense. So the issue of not wanting to feel less than, it comes back to this issue of social threat. Because when you feel like you don't belong or you are not part of, you are not seen as someone who is happening, then it means you are less than. No one will care about you.
But it's the second brain because it's a feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's the first brain because if you feel less than, it's a threat and therefore you feel unsafe.
Yes.
But you're not getting to the third brain.
You're not.
So Usually when you're feeling like that, you need to take a step back or take that deep breath that you mentioned. I mean, this works for me. I'm human like anyone else. I sometimes feel that way. I sometimes feel unsafe or threatened by something that isn't really a threat, but you have to stop yourself and go, let's just think about this.
Mm-hmm.
Clear the feelings out of the way and go, oh, actually, to react like that would be very bad. It would put me in a worse position. True. So let me reconsider. But, I mean, I don't always get it right. Nobody does always, but you've got to do that right.
And here's the thing, Gareth, that's very important that we need to understand about the brain. We are carrying an ancient brain in a high tech, in a technological world.
Mm.
So the world is highly technological. It's growing at an exponential rate.
Yes.
And yet the brain is almost linear. I mean, scientists have shown that it takes almost a million years to change the brain. I mean, like to adapt to what is happening. But when you look at how the world is actually changing and how things are evolving, the brain is not catching up. So the brain is still processing the information the same way it did million years ago. And that's a reason why we cannot catch up. So if you're not, because now people even talk about things like multitasking. There's nothing like that.
Yeah.
Multitasking does not happen. I mean, like people are just giving it. That in science, we call that task switching. Because each and every task that you are doing or you are performing has got its own path. You know, we call it neurological pathway.
That's interesting. So you do believe, and we are running out of time, but I think you've just hit on a fascinating thing. It's like, do you think that some people are just better pretending that they can multitask? Or do you think that there are people who are genuinely able to have a couple of things going on and they can do those task switchings very quickly?
The question is, when you're talking about multitasking, we need to firstly understand what we're talking about. Normally, when you're talking about tasks that are cognitively involved, I mean like involved, that require you to think, you cannot, the brain only has so much. You can, the brain operates in series, not in parallel. You can only perform one thing at a time. Right. You can't do things equally well. So what happens with the so-called multitasking? It compromises quality.
Right.
It compromises the duration of a task. Something that you could have done in an hour can take you 3 to 4 hours because you are switching tasks. So each time you move out of this path and do something else, when you come back, you need to reorient yourself and say, oh, by the way, where was I? You know, start to think about, by that time you're losing time, you're losing, you know, sort of like you compromise quality. So understanding how the brain works is such an important thing that we've never heard. I mean, it's something discussed at universities and that. So that's the reason why, therefore, I wrote this book, The Neuroscience of Effective Leadership, because effective leadership is something that does not start only with leading other people. It starts with yourself, managing your emotions, managing your own ideas, managing your own thinking, and managing your own dreams. Because at the end of the day, you can't just be a somnambulist or someone who is a sleepwalker. No, you've got to wake up.
That's very powerful stuff. What you just said now is probably going to hit home for a lot of people. You can't be expected to lead and to manage other people if you can't manage yourself.
Yep.
Absolutely, because why? Leadership is about influence. When I look at you, Gareth, doing what you do, and I say to myself, oh my goodness, I wish I can be like Gareth. So when you give me an idea or when you give me an advice, I'm going to listen to you. That's going to create something in the brain that is called a brain coupling. Because you do something that I believe in, something that I love. So when you talk to me or you talk with me, I'm going to listen to you with so much intense focus and attention because you make sense to me. Then I'm going to listen to you. That's where the politicians are taking advantage of people because you talk about things that you know that people want. Then people are going to listen to you. So you influence people in a bad way and people end up just following because you seem to be talking about something that they believe in.
I love this. I mean, I could talk to you for hours because I think this is fascinating. I'm sorry we spent any time about the politicians at all because we could have done without them. But for so many people who are listening to you, there's so many home truths that are hitting home and striking a chord now. I think it's great. Your book is called
the neuroscience of effective leadership.
There it is.
So this is about, sorry, because as Velindaba, the neuroengineer, which is the brain engineer, I'm all about transforming minds from mental darkness to mental light.
I love
it's
that.
About enlightening minds. It's about and showing them the. I normally carry my brain model with me just to take them through how the brain works.
I think in the front.
Yes, as well. You've got.
But
that.
I love this. So Veli, this is great, and you're a very positive guy. You believe that we all have the tools also to be able to start making positive changes in our own lives and getting ourselves right so we can manage other people and have a positive effect on the world. I love that. I think it's the perfect message to end on this Wednesday morning.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming to spend time with us.
Thank you very much.
Very interesting. I mean,
like, pleasure to meet you.
It's same here. Yeah. I mean, really, it was so exciting. And I think people can learn to understand that whatever that was given to them or what they learned at the beginning, they can unlearn it. So it's a process. The brain has got is plastic-like in nature. It can always evolve and change in structure and function based on how you use it.
I love this. Louis says in the comments, loving the show this morning, guys. Incredibly insightful. So many so-called leaders that I've dealt with in the past should listen to what Veli has to say.
Yes, sir.
Spot on, Louis. Veli, thank you. Jack, always good to spend time with you on a Wednesday morning.
Yes, sir.
And thank you for joining us. Have we passed the 50,000? Only 50 people. And then we're at 50,000 subscribers this morning. So it's very exciting. 50 grand in cash. Talk about motivation and incentive. You know that room full of money that Veli's talking about? Well, it could be yours. Get on there and get your friends, family, and everyone else you know to subscribe and get involved, because this is the place you get pills of wisdom like Veli was dropping this morning. Don't cast your wisdom at swine.
Absolutely. Right? I love that. I love that.
You know, don't want to waste it.
Trample on it.
Nobody who's joining us every morning, swine. I mean, some of them behave like that sometimes.
Yeah, they do.
We do too. All right, everybody. Have a happy day. We will see you on Friday.